The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy by Joe and Teresa Graydon. Reader treats rosacea. I know I probably mispronounced that. R-O-S-A-C-E-A. With milk of magnesia. Question. I read in your column recently about using milk of magnesia typically for rosacea. I have been using metronidazole to treat my acne redness for several years. It costs a lot of money, but I've not had much success. I tried milk of magnesia on my face starting 3 days ago, and my rosacea has almost completely disappeared. Best of all, it cost me only $2 a bottle versus $200 copay for metronidazole. Answer. Metronidazole is an antimicrobial medication commonly used to treat rosacea. In this inflammatory skin condition, the face flushes easily and may stay reddened. There may be bumps that look like pimples. Thickened bumps may form, especially on the nose. We could not find any published studies of the effects of milk of magnesia on rosacea, although many readers have been equally enthusiastic. It certainly is less expensive than your metronidazole. If you need that prescription, ask the pharmacist how much it would cost to pay out of pocket instead of using insurance. You might save money. Question. For several years, I've had bouts of esophagus, which meant an emergency trip to the emergency room to have it ballooned or expanded. The episodes became more frequent. The last ones were weeks apart. Since I'm a longtime user of soap in my bed for leg cramps, I placed a bar next to my throat, and the tightening immediately stopped. When I needed help after that, it was always soap to the rescue. Soon the episodes stopped completely. It's been over 3 years since that last ER visit. In addition, my husband had a hacking cough. I put a bar of soap in front of his throat, and the cough stopped. I made him a necklace with a knee-high nylon stocking with soap chips knotted into it. As long as he wears it, he doesn't cough. Answer. We are intrigued by your report. It is quite similar to another amazing story we heard from a person with laryngeal spasm. That reader also made a necklace to allow wearing a chip of soap at the throat to prevent the spasm. We don't know how soap would work in such situations, but we suspect it is activating TRP, which is transient receptor potential, channels in the nerves that may prevent them from going into overdrive and causing unwanted spontaneous muscle contractions, leg cramps, or spasms to your esophagus. Did aspirin cause leaky heart valve? Question. Without a doctor's instruction and unbeknownst to his family, my father was popping one regular strength aspirin a day for years. When he was rushed to the hospital, they found a heart valve leaking, and they implied the aspirin my father admitted to taking was probably the cause. Answer. We hate it when doctors blame the patient for a condition they have no control over. A leaky heart valve is not your father's fault. Your father probably was trying to protect his heart with aspirin based on information that this inexpensive drug can prevent repeat heart attacks. The latest research shows, however, that for people at low risk, the increased danger of bleeding may outweigh any benefit. And that's in the new issue, The Lancet, August 26, 2018. In addition, your father was taking a higher dose than would be recommended even for those at great risk of a recurrent heart attack. Question. I have been taking Atenolol to control my blood pressure for some years now. Perhaps as a result, I feel very foggy and tired. When I mentioned this, my doctor suggested I change to Kozar. I have read a number of patient reviews about the serious side effects of Kozar, and I am concerned. Is there any data about the relative safety of the two drugs? And the answer is, you have asked an excellent question. Both Atenolol and Losartan, or Kozar, have been used for decades, so you might imagine that comparing their safety would be relatively simple. However, head-to-head trials, particularly those focusing on adverse effects, are not common. Both drugs lower blood pressure, but atenolol is no longer considered a first-line treatment for high blood pressure. And that's cited in the Cochrane Database of Systemic Reviews, January 20, 2017. That is primarily because it is not effective in preventing stroke and coronary heart disease, as other types of blood pressure medicines are. At least one study comparing the two drugs found that people had fewer side effects on losartan than on atenolol. That's from the Journal of Hypertension, September 2002. The most common side effects from atenolol include fatigue, dizziness, depression, slow heart rate, cold hands and feet, and breathing difficulties. Losartan also can cause fatigue or weakness, dizziness, digestive distress, and cough. From the Wall Street Journal, Hospitals Step Up the War on Superbugs by Lucette Legnado. During 32 years as a physician, Daniel Fetterman has used a stethoscope to listen to patients' hearts and lungs. But a recent study at the West Haven, Connecticut Veterans Hospital, where Dr. Fetterman works, left him aghast. After seeing an image of the bacteria accumulated on his stethoscope, he admits, "I was appalled. The basic fact is that I don't recall cleaning my stethoscope ever, nor apparently did many of his colleagues." Healthcare-acquired infections, maladies associated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, kill tens of thousands of patients a year in American hospitals. On any given day, approximately 1 in 25 patients develops at least one infection contracted during hospital care, says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, demonstrating the need for improved infection control in U.S. health care facilities. To curb infections, hospitals are setting more rigorous hygiene standards, focusing on commonplace equipment such as stethoscopes and blood pressure cuffs, which can collect bacteria and potentially transmit disease. Medical centers have stepped up efforts to get doctors to clean their hands thoroughly. Some institutions are trying ultraviolet cleaning systems, while others have turned to copper, which some believe reduces bacteria. Many researchers say there isn't definitive proof that germy stethoscopes can make patients sick, but dirty stethoscopes carry as many germs as unwashed hands, some infection control specialists say. These experts say that just as doctors have been taught to wash or clean their hands between patients, they also must learn to clean their stethoscopes. One easy method, applying sanitizing foam to the stethoscope's diaphragm, the part that touches the patient's skin, after using it on their own hands. A 2014 study at a Swiss hospital published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings found that the contamination level of the stethoscope is substantial after a single physical examination and comparable to the contamination of parts of the physician's dominant hand. Its lead author, Didier Pittet, says that while hand hygiene remains the priority in fighting infection, he instituted the stethoscope cleaning requirement at his institution, the University of Geneva Hospitals. New York University Langone Hospital, Brooklyn, recently conducted a clinical trial examining stethoscopes for bacteria. Marwa Musa, an attending physician, decided that medical residents should learn early on to clean their stethoscopes. "You wash your hands, but you never clean your stethoscopes," Dr. Musa says. Her analysis found that some of the stethoscope's diaphragms were rife with bacteria, including the superbug methicillin-resistant staph, aureus, which can lead to fatal antibiotic-resistant infections. Louise Dembry, a professor of infectious diseases and epidemiology at Yale, helped conduct the VA Connecticut Healthcare System's stethoscope study. Dr. Fetterman, the system's associate chief of medicine, was among the 50 or so attending physicians, residents, and medical students who took part, turning over their stethoscopes to be examined. Dr. Dembry says while it can be very hard to show that using a germ-ridden stethoscope on a patient directly poses a risk, in medicine it isn't black and white. It's all about infection prevention. Our role is to minimize risk. So it makes sense to put controls in place. Education alone doesn't work, she said. This is about human behavior and creating a new habit. Study participants gathered before a big screen and were shown pictures of the bacteria on their stethoscopes. When the bugs appeared, there was an audible reaction, including yucks. Dr. Fetterman recalls, the images were really disgusting. Everyone seemed shocked at the results. Dr. Fetterman, a professor of medicine at Yale, says seasoned doctors may be more prone to ignore the potential for contamination than younger colleagues who trained in the era of superbugs. We have the knowledge to prevent infections. What has been lacking is the will, says Betsy McCauley, a patient advocate and founder of Reduce Infection Deaths, a nonprofit that flags dangers that leave hospitals vulnerable to superbugs. Stanford Health in Stamford, Connecticut, says it has made environmental hygiene a priority. Michael Perry, director of infectious diseases, sees many potential nooks for germs to gather. There are telephones, there are call buttons, there are IV poles, there are stethoscopes. One of his big worries, computer keyboards. Now Stanford Hospital has a computer in every patient room for staff to assess records. That way, Dr. Perry says, you aren't taking the computer from room to room and spreading germs. Sentara Healthcare, based in Norfolk, Virginia, embraced a novel weapon to fight superbugs, copper. Convinced that copper has germ-fighting qualities, the hospital system invested in copper surfaces for countertops and bed rails, bed tables, and other furniture. Sentara also started using copper-infused linens, including patient gowns, bed sheets, towels, and washcloths. In a study comparing a new hospital building outfitted with copper and an unchanged older facility next door, there were dramatic reductions in superbugs in the new building, said Howard Kern, Sentara's president and CEO. He plans to retrofit other Sentara hospitals with copper. Dr. Pite of the University of Geneva Hospitals isn't sold on copper's germ-fighting properties. The scientific evidence that copper reduces healthcare-associated infections is quite weak, he says. At UCLA Health, Mark Sklansky, a pediatric cardiologist, was so concerned about germs that it could be spread by doctors, he tried to convert two neonatal intensive care units into handshake-free zones in 2015. The campaign, which was part of a formal study, never really caught on, even though the NICUs still have signs that depict a crossed-out handshake. Hospitals, Dr. Slansky laments, aren't ready to recommend handshake-free zones. How University of Southern Cal's blind player muscled up, by Jen Murphy. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. After discovering he could be a long snapper even without sight, Jake Olson added 50 pounds to get into the game. Jake Olson's last wish before he lost his vision was to watch his favorite football team, the University of Southern California Trojans. At age 12, when he attended a USC practice, he thought his wildest football fantasies had come true. Mr. Olson never imagined that he'd suit up in cardinal and gold for the Trojans years later. Mr. Olson, 21, was born with a rare form of eye cancer. He lost his left eye as a baby, but that didn't stop him from embracing sports as a boy. I absolutely loved sports, soccer, baseball, basketball, football, but I was only good at seeing the bodies, he says. I definitely took a few balls off the face. Doctors removed his right eye, too, after years of treatments. As a kid, it was pretty devastating, he says. I realized I could sit around and sulk about the one thing I lost, or continue to do the things I love, and be grateful that I have an athletic body and mind. The idea of playing football sounded absurd, but he thought he might be able to be a long snapper. He just had to master the crucial backward toss to the holder during an extra point or field goal attempt. Heading into his junior year at Orange Lutheran High School in California's Orange County, Mr. Olson spent every day in July mastering the art of the snap, I remember my first snap hit the ground and bounced off my coach's foot, he recalls. He kept practicing and earned a spot on the varsity team. A teammate would guide Mr. Olson onto the field and square his hips, and the kicker clapped to let Mr. Olson know how far back to snap the ball. After getting into USC, he walked onto the football team in 2015, a scrawny freshman at 6'4", 185 pounds. The coaches expected him to get stronger if he wanted to see game time. He dedicated himself to the gym and put on 50 pounds by his junior year. The hard work paid off. Last September, Mr. Olson got his first taste of game action, successfully snapping an extra point in the Trojans' season opener against Western Michigan. It was one of my favorite moments in life, he says. Mr. Olson isn't cleared for contact during games, but Trojans head coach Clay Helton has an agreement with opponents that if Mr. Olson snaps, the defense won't rush the USC line. He has appeared late in games where USC has a strong lead, including this month's season opener, a 43-21 win over UNLV. He snapped on the Trojans' final extra point attempt. This offseason, Mr. Olson made headlines with feats that included driving a car for the first time at a NASCAR track and jumping off a high dive platform. He even posted a video on Twitter showing off his quarterback skills. A business major, Mr. Olson has 2 years of eligibility left with the team, but plans to hang up his football helmet after graduation this spring to pursue another sport, golf. Mr. Olson, who shoots in the 70s and 80s, wants to compete in blind golf tournaments. The workout, a bodybuilding-based strength routine and smarter nutrition, help Mr. Olson attain his physique. Nick Donnelly, a former strength and conditioning intern at USC, took Mr. Olson under his wing freshman year. I remember initially guiding Jake around the weight room, watching him hit his head or shin and feeling like a terrible coach, says Mr. Donnelly, who serves as the head strength coach at St. Joseph's Collegiate Institute in Buffalo, New York. He had to constantly remind me that he wasn't made of glass. His first 2 years, Mr. Olson followed a high-volume strength program, doing 5 sets of 10 to 20 reps of heavy weights. While Mr. Olson had lifted in high school, Mr. Donnelly says he had to teach him the feel of a muscle being activated. It was very hands-on, Mr. Donnelly says. I would grab the muscle he was supposed to be working during an incline bench or lat pull down and tell him to isolate it so he could learn the feeling. Now he's built like a brick wall with his arms popping out of his jersey. In the off-season, Mr. Olson called Mr. Donnelly 3 times a week to discuss tweaks to his routine. He was in the weight room for 60 to 90 minutes, 5 days a week. He did chest Mondays, legs Tuesdays, arms Wednesdays, shoulders and back Thursdays, and anything I missed Fridays. Now that he's put on mass, he switched to a program that concentrates on lower weights and higher repetitions. He prefers high-intensity training to cardio, but will ride the stationary bike for a few miles to get his heart rate up. Mr. Olson says mobility is key to snapping. I do a ton of stretches for my shoulders, hips, and legs, he says. I'm pretty much a quarterback just throwing the ball through my legs. My shoulder and back muscles pull the ball through. As for accuracy, whether it's football or a golf ball, Mr. Olson says repetition is key to mastering the feel of perfect snap or putt. The diet. Mr. Olson starts his day with 3 eggs over easy, potatoes or toast, fruit, and some type of meat, like sausage. I try to stay away from bacon, but it's a losing battle, he says. He prefers a glass of whole or 2% milk to coffee. Lunch might be a turkey sandwich. Dinner is his favorite meal. He eats pasta nearly every night, usually with fish and a vegetable. Strawberry or coconut cream pie are his splurges. The gear. Mr. Olson is a fan of Titleist and TaylorMade golf clubs and FootJoy golf shoes. Pre or post workout, he uses a foam roller, baseball, or softball to release tight muscles. The playlist, he used to listen to rap when training with Mr. Donnelly, but he prefers hard rock or metal bands. Blind athletes get into games. Blind and visually impaired athletes can benefit both mentally and physically from sports, says Courtney Patterson, a spokeswoman for the United States Association of Blind Athletes in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Running is the most popular sport among the visually impaired, she says. It's cost-effective, and some people have enough vision to run along a line or a track. When it comes to winding roads or trails, she says, there are many organizations like Achilles International that pair visually impaired runners with guides. There are also adaptive versions of popular team sports. And beep ball, a variation on baseball, players aim to hit a ball larger than a softball that beeps. Bases buzz when the ball is hit, so players know which way to run. The Paralympic sport of goal ball is the most popular team sport for the blind and visually impaired, Ms. Patterson says. The sport, a cross between soccer and dodgeball, was developed in 1946 as a way to keep blinded World War II veterans physically active. The teams of three players each try to roll a basketball-sized ball with bells inside over the opponent's goal line. The opponents listen for the oncoming ball. Advisors seek to fund blindness cure. And this is by Christina Rexrode from the Wall Street Journal. Karen Petrow, an influential advisor to bankers and regulators, has made a career of deciphering complicated financial regulations. Now she is trying to decode another type of puzzle. The conundrum? Matching medical researchers who need money with investors who have it. A bill outlining her strategy, which would include a government guarantee, was introduced in the House of Representatives last month. Her goal to cure blindness is lofty and her crusade is personal. Though Ms. Petrow, who runs policy analysis firm Federal Financial Analytics, Inc., consumes dense regulatory tomes faster than perhaps anyone in Washington, it has been years since she could see. Ms. Petrow, 65 years old, is unsentimental about finance, where the sharp contours of profit trump the squishy metrics of doing good. But she also believes pension funds, insurers, and others will invest in her I-bonds, if they can make money doing it. The plan, which she designed with her husband and business partner, Basil, envisions a five-year pilot that would finance as much as $1 billion in loans for organizations doing early-stage research on blindness. In the scheme of Wall Street, it's lunch money anyway, Ms. Petrou said, and maybe it appeals to what's left of their heartstrings. Under their proposal, labs and others would get a stamp of approval for projects deemed promising by the National Eye Institute, a designation that could help them line up loans. The lenders would sell the loans to an eye bond trust administered by a financial institution that would package it and sell the loans to investors. She envisions 10-year bonds. Investors would be repaid both the principal and interest when the bonds mature, and if a lab's project turns into a commercial success, the investors could get equity. A government guarantee would partially protect investors if the labs can't repay. She has now gained a reputation for knowing the minutiae of esoteric regulations and their big picture repercussions. Banks and regulators hire her to provide a nonpartisan analysis of the potential effects of new policies. I'm not coming up with loopholes, she said. Roger Cohen, senior chairman of Sullivan and Cromwell LLP, met Mrs. Petrou in the early 1990s when they worked on the merger of Mellon Bank Corporation and Dreyfus Corporation, a controversial proposal at the time because it combined a bank and a mutual fund business. She gave a very broad-based view of everything that was going on, how the regulators would work, how Congress would react, and how the media would react, Mr. Cohen said. It was typical of her approach and forthrightness. If you're going to challenge Karen on a fact, you better be right, said Pete Mills, who worked for Ms. Petrow and is now head of residential public policy for the Mortgage Bankers Association. You can't get anything by her. In recent years, Ms. Petrow has grown more outspoken about the widening gap between rich and poor, including her belief that post-crisis government policy has exacerbated the problem. In a lecture to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York this year, she scolded central bankers for years of ultra-low interest rates. Her take, the policy has boosted the stock market, which benefits investors, but harmed families trying to set aside savings. With I-bonds, the Petros aren't looking to reinvent themselves, but to be heard on a different issue. They believe the obstacle to curing blindness isn't a lack of science, but a lack of funding. Though it is in early days for the I-bonds, they hope their structure or something similar could be applied to other diseases. People always say, why is this for blindness? Ms. Petro said. And I said, well, I'm blind, so let's start with that. Sight deteriorated over several years. Karen Petro grew up in a liberal leaning home in Westchester County, New York, to an artist's mother and a book publisher father. As a child, she once challenged the rabbi teaching her Sunday school class to an intellectual disputation, said her mother, Blanche Dolmach. As a teenager, she donned a colonial dress and mob cap to give tours of Phillipsburg Manor in Sleepy Hollow, New York. She was always good at making speeches and instructing on things and blowing off intellectual steam, Ms. Dolmatch said. In high school, Ms. Petrou was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa disorder that causes gradual vision loss. We just kind of staggered out of the place, Ms. Dolmatch recalled. Within a few years, acquaintances complained Ms. Petrou didn't say hi when she passed them. Her peripheral vision was failing. At the same time, she was working on a doctorate in political science at the University of California, Berkeley. But she took a job in banking, figuring it would offer more opportunities for women than academia. Along the way, Ms. Petrou's sight continued to deteriorate. She lost her reading vision 6 months after starting her firm. Wary of being pitied or stereotyped, she would tell people she couldn't see a menu because she had lost a contact lens. Today, she is almost completely blind, though many of her clients don't know until her German Shepherd guide dog, Zuni, trundles into their boardroom. She ingests volumes of ponderous regulatory documents by listening to screen reading software at 400 words a minute. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.